From KCUR News, this is Casey Currents reporting news and culture in Kansas City's diverse communities and beyond. I'm Susan Wilson.
And I'm Alex Smith. Sylvia Maria Gross is away this week. On this week's show, when a little voter fraud makes a big difference.
Every vote counts. And in this case, it was true. And there were two votes that came from outside the district. And it swung an election.
Once again, it's state fair season.
I weighed 97 pounds before I came to the fair the first time. And now look at me. You know, it's because of the Missouri State Fair.
And two married composers from China who both support and critique each other's work.
We give a very direct comment and criticism, and that really helps. And sometimes it hurts, but as an artist, you know, that's the job. You have to do it.
Listen up for Casey Currents just after this hour's news.
I'm Alex Smith.
And I'm Susan Wilson. Casey Currents is KCUR's weekly magazine show. We use voices, stories, and sound to take you to neighborhoods around the region. In June, a Kansas City couple pled guilty to voter fraud in the 2010 Democratic primary. Even in a low turnout primary for a state legislature seat, two votes would normally be a drop in the bucket. But in this race, John Joseph Rizzo defeated Will Royster by a margin of one vote. Rizzo went on to win the election and was reelected to the seat in 2012. The kicker, that couple who voted in a district where they didn't live, is Rizzo's aunt and uncle. Steve Vockrott has a story about that election in this week's pitch. He told Casey Currents' Sylvia Maria Gross why he thought it was important to follow up on this fraud case.
Well, when the news came out that there were the two guilty pleas in a one-vote race, and given that the two guilty pleas came from relatives of the winning race, of course, we don't know for sure how they voted, but it's reasonable to say that they might have voted for their nephew. I thought it was striking how little outrage it seemed like there was and how little media follow-up it seemed like there was. It almost seemed like it was treated like a quaint issue. And we've heard a lot about voter fraud over the years, but this was a very demonstrable case that happened in Kansas City. You know, we always say that every vote counts. And in this case, it was true. And there were two votes that came from outside the district, and it swung an election. And I thought that was important.
And it's only Will Royster who lost the election who's tried to maintain this focus on that election and the other malfeasance that he believes might have occurred. Why is he still so focused on it?
In a way, I can't really blame him. I mean, he can make a very reasonable case for the fact that an election was stolen from him. It was his first bid for public office. And I think for any political candidate, even for a house race in Missouri, it's a lot of time. It's a lot of your own time. It's a lot of your own money. My sense was from talking to him, I think he feels like people didn't care. He feels like authorities didn't investigate it. He feels like, you know, that the fraud was perpetrated and it didn't really make much of a splash. And so I think that's why he's still very vocal about this case, even to some detriment to himself, I would argue.
And does he believe that this fraud was orchestrated by the Rizzo campaign?
Yeah, I get the sense that he thinks that it was. I think one of the big questions and one of the things I would have really liked to talk to John Rizzo, who is now the state representative, is what did he know and when did he know it? And was he a knowing participant or did he just have no idea? I think that's the one question that kind of eluded the story. I couldn't get in touch with Mr. Rizzo, but to me, that's one of the big outstanding mysteries of this whole case.
And Royster is claiming that there was more voter fraud, or at least would like an investigation.
Right. So what we know is that two people have pleaded guilty. But what Royster says is that there was perhaps some other examples where votes could have been miscast. There were some ballots that turned up that didn't have judges' initials, which in most cases they're supposed to have from the voting booth. And there's also allegations from several people, election volunteers and election workers, who say that there was some electioneering going on within the booths. And a lot of those center around the Somali community in the Northeast neighborhood, which is one of the, which is one of many ethnic groups there. But that there were several who entered the polling places, and in some cases with John Rizzo yard signs, and people directing others to, you know, vote for Rizzo. And anybody who votes knows that that's not supposed to happen inside the polling place. And in fact, there's supposed to be a certain distance outside the voting place where those kinds of conversations can occur.
And you report that this was reported by two different election judges, which you point out, one a Democrat and one a Republican, by the way.
Right. At least two. I think there, and there were some other people who gave some testimony to a similar effect. And the election supervisors, or the election board is headquartered in Union Station, got calls during that day from folks who reported similar allegations.
So whose responsibility is it to investigate voter fraud like this?
Well, the authorities, in this case, we've had a federal investigation. The FBI took an interest in the case. And it wasn't until the first guilty plea came down in the case, which was John Mortina, John Rizzo's uncle. He pleaded guilty earlier this year to federal charges. And it was at that point that the Kansas City Police Department started to investigate. Will Royster, the records show that Will Royster had met with the Jackson County Prosecutor's Office. And at that point is when the Kansas City Police started to take up the various allegations. And they investigated a lot of what Royster said had happened, such as some votes that appeared to come from vacant properties. Those didn't turn up anything, any wrongdoing in the investigation. But the Kansas City Police Department did find that the Mortinas, who were the two that ended up pleading guilty, did appear to commit voter fraud, and that case was forwarded up to the prosecutor's office.
And that's when they again pleaded guilty to a state charge?
Right, to a state-level charge. They were fined, and they're barred from voting. But it's worth pointing out that that was almost 3 years after the fact.
And your story starts out that Royster is now taking this to the Kansas City Election Board. What does he want from them?
The election board has made statements in the past that there were no voters from outside the district that voted in the race. And Royster wants an acknowledgement from the election board that there were indeed voters who cast impermissible votes. And he wants some acknowledgement from the election board that parts of the election had not been managed well. You know, one of the questions I had for Royster is, what will that do for you if the election board makes that acknowledgement? But that seems to be something that's important to him, that he still wants.
Do you think this many irregularities are typical in any local election like this? Or is there evidence that there was either incompetence on the part of election officials or dirty politics?
There are a lot of allegations that dirty politics took place. It was hard for me to find direct proof of that. I mean, there weren't, from what I could find, a lot of smoking guns that pointed to dirty politics. A lot of suggestions that some of that may have taken place. There is some evidence in the record that it was an election that was run in a sloppy way. If the allegations of the electioneering are true, and there hasn't been in court or in official documents any suggestion that it was not true. That points to an election that was run in kind of a sloppy way.
In any sense, I don't know if you've looked at other cases like this, if that sloppiness is typical.
That's a hard question to answer, because we do hear of a lot of allegations, and even going back to 2000 in Florida with the presidential election, and then 2004 with the presidential election in Ohio, there are a lot of allegations. But as far as ironclad proof, resulting in convictions, we haven't seen too much of that. And that's what makes this case, to me, so striking, is the fact that we have people who've gone to court and they've gotten their wrists slapped. And it's almost a perfect storm, to use that overused cliche, because it was a one-vote race and we have two votes that were cast impermissibly, not only impermissibly, but by a relative of the candidate who won by a single vote.
And now this case has been cited by Kansas Secretary of State Kris Kobach as being an example of the voter fraud he's trying to combat with voter identification laws. he points particularly to this case with the Somalis who were, it's alleged, they were directed by someone to vote in a particular way. He calls them Somali citizens, and I wonder, do you know whether they were American citizens or Somali citizens or both?
There's no evidence that I found that suggests that they were unregistered voters, that they shouldn't have been casting ballots, just that they were directed to vote in a certain way. And again, it's important to remember that we don't know how they voted. It's plausible they voted for Royster. I mean, Royster did try and court the Somali voting bloc in the Northeast. They were directed, according to these affidavits and some of the testimony from the election judges, to vote a certain way. We don't know exactly how they voted. We don't know that they should not have been registered. That hasn't emerged. There were Somali voters who were registered to vote in the race, and so far the evidence hasn't shown that there were votes that shouldn't have been cast.
This case presumably could fuel the argument that there is voter fraud happening in our elections. Do you get the sense that that might be some of the reason why people don't want to talk about it, or particularly Democrats don't want to talk about it, who tend to be against voter identification type laws?
Yeah, there's no question that voter ID laws, it's a partisan issue. It's something that the Republicans have pushed for, and it's something that Democrats in large measure have said it's kind of an invented issue by the Republicans. You know, without taking a stand either way, I think there is a reasonable discussion that could be held with regards to a race like this, where it is shown that it can occur. And it appears, at least in this case, to be as easy as filling out a registration card saying that you live in a certain address, even though the Mortinas were paying taxes on their property in Gladstone, which is in a different county altogether, let alone representative district.
Are there any repercussions? Have there been any sort of embarrassment for State Rep. John Rizzo now in the state legislature?
There was some discussion in a previous legislative session that there was a possibility that he could be denied a seat, which is a rare move, but there is the authority for that to happen. But it appears that the legislature, in terms of investigating this, has lost interest in doing anything like that. I mean, Rizzo ran again in 2012 without opposition and won, which I think has been taken by Rizzo supporters as evidence that there's support for him in his district, enough so that people wouldn't run against him. But, you know, as far as political consequences, it's hard to say. He's the minority whip. He's got a leadership position in the House. And so that would suggest that the political consequences haven't been severe for him, although there are those in the Northeast who speculate that this latest guilty plea may earn him an opponent in the next race.
Now, of course, both Rizzo and Royster are the children of former state reps, and we haven't mentioned this yet, but Rizzo's dad is Henry Rizzo, who's now a Jackson County legislator and seen as a big player in local politics. How is that significant here?
Henry Rizzo is an influential person in local politics. As you said, he's a power player, and that lends some fuel to Royster's argument that he was able to do some electioneering. Him and his supporters have been able to stifle some of the outrage, if you will, appears to be largely absent from this whole case.
And you point out in the article that they represented maybe two different factions of the Northeast, Kansas City's historic Northeast community. Mm-hmm. Can you talk about who each candidate represented in that 2010 election?
Rizzo seemed to represent the old guard, if you will, of the Northeast, seen as the folks who'd been there for a while, who remember that his father, Henry Rizzo, had been a House representative for the district, and not just a representative, but a pretty influential one in the 90s. And that the Northeast neighborhoods had more political cachet in Jefferson City than they do now. And Will Royster appealed more to the new guard of the Northeast neighborhoods, the folks who were buying up some of those old stately homes in the Skerrett Renaissance neighborhood in Pendleton Heights and rebuilding some of those houses and some of the neighborhoods in the Northeast. That was who Royster counted on for a lot of his votes.
Interestingly, neither of those groups really represents the large population of immigrants and refugees in the Northeast. And I wonder if they're really involved in politics at all right now.
The diversity in the Northeast, you have a Vietnamese population, you have a Middle East population, you have a Somali population. It makes it difficult to campaign. You have to appeal to a lot of different groups and reach out to a lot of those different groups. And they do appear to be involved. But voter involvement as a whole in the Northeast has certainly dropped from where it was in the 90s.
How many people actually voted in that 2010 Democratic primary?
You have about 1,300, at least in that race for both candidates, because John Rizzo won with 664 votes and Will Royster won with 663. So that's a little more than 1,300. Although, interestingly, I did get an email today from someone who voted in that race, and they said that given the amount of negative campaigning, it was really a nasty race. And he told me that given the amount of negative campaigning that went on in that race, he opted not to vote for either candidate. He didn't feel like either one deserved to win.
It brings us back to that cliche, every vote counts, doesn't it?
It certainly does.
Steve Vakrat is a reporter for The Pitch. His article about voter fraud in a 2010 election in the Old Northeast neighborhood of Kansas City is in this week's magazine. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
For over three decades, two nuns have run a daycare and social service agency at 31st and Troost that's provided mostly single moms with the freedom to work. Operation Breakthrough began with the sisters agreeing to care for a few babies so that their mothers could take jobs, often at odd hours and far from home. Today, Operation Breakthrough is an $8 million agency and is one of the few agencies that offers so-called wraparound services, services beyond daycare that support the whole family. The thinking is that daycare isn't very useful if a family has no food, medical care, or housing. The sisters who founded Operation Breakthrough are now in their 70s. As Laura Ziegler reports, Operation Breakthrough is looking forward as the sisters are thinking about retiring.
Sister Berta Saylor and Sister Carita Bussimus are having a family photo this afternoon in their Raytown backyard.
Living with the nuns. We're going to start this
today. He wants to start a TV show, Living with the Nuns.
This is not your typical big suburban brood. Eight young black kids ranging in age from 25 to 1, including a nonverbal teenager in a wheelchair born addicted to 12 different drugs, and two white nuns in baggy shirts and pants. Some of these kids have lived here their whole lives. Some are foster kids. Some just come and go.
Okay, right here. Everybody right here at me.
The sisters have been taking care of kids for 42 years. They began while teaching middle school at St. Vincent's Parish in Kansas City because, Sister Carita says, some of the mothers in the neighborhood weren't working because they couldn't afford childcare.
You know, in those days, middle and upper class people, the wife stayed home and the husband worked. Well, a lot of our single moms needed childcare, and it wasn't a regulated industry then at all.
And so the nuns hired a woman from the neighborhood to watch the kids while they were teaching. At first there were four, soon there were 10, then 20. They needed more space. What began as an informal arrangement evolved into an official daycare center. In 1981, they moved into the old Penny's department store building at 31st and Troost.
And we named it Operation Breakthrough for two reasons. We were going to break through poverty. And it was during the Vietnam War, and we thought the government would think it was part of the war effort and give us money, but that didn't happen.
Sister Carita says they got by because they didn't have to pay much for staff.
Oh, yes, I would have to say their salary was definitely a volunteer salary.
You know, it was during the days of the Flower Children and the Vietnam War, then there were a lot of conscientious objectors. Most of them lived in our house with us. So they got like $20 a month for teaching in the school or working in the child care center.
Four decades later, Sister Berta says the agency has never had any legal problems involving the children and that it's filling an increasingly essential need for poor women struggling to support families on low-wage jobs. Missouri's cut funding for child care, which means fewer families are subsidized. Currently, about a third of the kids at Operation Breakthrough go for free. The center offers early childhood education and medical and dental services, social workers, therapists, a food and clothes pantry for the families. Operation Breakthrough has prospered largely due to the charismatic leadership of the two nuns, but the sisters are aging and their retirement is imminent. Last year, 79-year-old Carita fell and broke a bone in her back. It's unclear if she'll be able to come back to work. Jennifer Heinemann, director of development, misses Carita's calming influence.
Sister Carita is always a source of faith for all of us. She's not the worrier. Sister Berta worries and worries and worries, and Sister Carita just smiles and says, it'll be all right.
Sister Berta, now 76, still puts in 10-hour days, but admits she's also slowing down. Susan Stanton, who came on as CEO and president of Operation Breakthrough last year, says the nuns will always be the face of the agency, but childcare has changed.
The management has to be more intentional than the entrepreneurial spirit that Sister Berta and Sister Carita had when they started. You know, you just can't. I think they will acknowledge there's a little bit of by the seat of their pants. Just do it.
Back at the house, the kids who live with Sister Berta and Sister Carita lounge together on a wraparound couch. I asked them if they understand what their foster mothers have done. Cordell Miller has lived virtually his whole life here. He's leaving this week for college at Missouri Science and Technology in Rolla.
Watching them do their job and being down at Operation Breakthrough and hearing a lot of the stories that they come home and discuss, to be able to say, oh, I'm going to college to major to be an engineer, or oh, I want to be a pre-med or pre-vet, is just amazing and a blessing to say. So I guess that's one thing I take from them, and when they're gone, let that live through me.
Sisters Berta and Carita leave a legacy with dozens of kids like Cordell who've lived under their roof at one time or another. Their legacy also is permanent at Operation Breakthrough, though it's widely believed that once they're no longer there, the organization will never be quite the same. Laura Ziegler, KCUR News.
Coming up, local rapper G. Watts makes waves on the national scene. You're listening to KC Currents. This is KC Currents. I'm Susan Wilson.
And I'm Alex Smith. Sylvia is away this week. It's August. The days are growing shorter. Fall is approaching, but summer isn't done just yet. All over the country, folks are flocking to that ultimate summer tradition, the state fair. Carnival rides and games, meat on a stick, livestock competitions. The Midwest does state fairs right. But not all of us can get out there. That's why Harvest Public Media is bringing us this trip to the state fairs in Iowa, Missouri, and Illinois.
I'm Gary Slater. I'm the manager and CEO of the Iowa State Fair.
Thank you.
And the Iowa State Fair is what I think is an American classic state fair. I always say that Colorado has the Rocky Mountains, Minnesota has the lakes. We have the Iowa State Fair, and that's what the people really love.
I'll have a deep fried brownie on a stick, please.
I'm Dale Moreland. I live in Dexter, Missouri, and I show draft mules, halter class, as well as hook to the wagon, hitch classes. I've been coming to the Missouri State Fair since I was a child. Came here with my grandpa, so the fair is very special to me. And my dream was to show mules here. My job didn't allow me to show mules. I come and watch the mules, and I help other people show, but I couldn't bring my mules. So 2 years ago when I retired, I was able to come and show my own mules. And it's just been my dream to show mules here at the fair, and here I am, and I love it.
My name's Chris Hughes, and I can remember coming down to the fair as a little boy with my parents and going to see Otto the car, talking car, and the locomotive, riding the trams, you know, going to all the Cadillac expositions, and it just brought back a lot of memories doing that again when you bring little ones down. And I weighed 97 pounds before I came to the fair the first time, and now look at me. You know, it's because of the Missouri State Fair. Those $2 corn dogs, you betcha. You know, there's nothing better than the Missouri State Fair corn dogs.
Bacon wrapped
ribbon
stick. Just one?
One,
yes.
Case. Special attractions, the Illinois State Fair. Check out the Twilight Ballroom and taste wine from 20 Illinois.
650, got to be 40,750. Where? I got 40,650. Got to be 40,750. 40,750. Yes, sir, no. All done. sold $40,650 right there.
And I always say, you cannot see the Iowa State Fair in one day. It takes, you got to come back more than once.
A little postcard from the state fairs in Iowa, Missouri, and Illinois. It came to us from Harvest Public Media reporters Amy Mayer, Abby Fintress-Swanson, Bill Wheelhouse, and Jeremy Bernfeld. Check out their photos at harvestpublicmedia.org.
One for the money, two for my bros, three for the city, now everybody knows.
And now, back in KC, many young urban men see rap music as a ticket to a better, more prosperous life, but few ever even get a start in the music industry. 23-year-old G. Watts, however, has as good a chance as any. His new mixtape, What's Up, has been featured in Quincy Jones' music magazine, The Source, and other major industry publications and blogs. The track Watts R-I-O-T or Riot features the Kansas City native rhyming with L.A. rapper Kendrick Lamar, a rising hip-hop sensation who made his name on the internet. Just a few days after the release of the Watts collaboration with Lamar, the song had more than 16,000 listens. Back in May, I spoke with G. Watts to find out more about how that collaboration happened.
He said my name on Twitter, but he didn't say my name. He was just like, what's up to my G's out there, something. And so I tweeted him. I was like, what you saying my name for? And he was like, huh? And I was like, you trying to do a song? And so, you know, and it grew from that. He was like, DM me. And, you know, ever since we had a cordial relationship with each other.
So when you first reached out to him like that, did you really expect that he was going to take the time to listen to your music?
Because when I reached out to him, he wasn't Kendrick Lamar like he is now. I hit him up probably a week or two before the Dr. Dre co-sign. That's God. Mm-hmm. You know what I'm saying? Divine intervention. And so he really wasn't the man that he is, but, you know.
Okay. What kind of influenced
that song?
Yeah, your song, your lyrics.
He came, K-Dot came to Kansas City on tour with Drake. Before he came, he sent me a text like, yo, I think I got one for you for my album. I was like, psh, it's all I needed to hear. And so when he came, played the beat for me, he was in the middle of rapping / writing his verse. He had half of it already recorded, half we were still trying to piece together. And he told me, he was like, hey, man, when I lay this down, I'm going to get it to you. Take it, marinate, live with it, and send it back. I was like, you still writing your verses? I got about 8 bars. And so as a competitor, I was like, I don't need to take nothing home. I'll write right here with you.
So I want you to paint a picture, because I heard Kendrick's verse was actually recorded on a tour bus. What was that like?
Yeah, it was me, him, his security guard, and my girl, actually. We was on the bus just sitting there watching, and she was like, oh, my God, are you excited? Are you excited? And I was like, girl, it's meant to be. Like, no, I'm not excited. I'm happy and I'm grateful that I'm the one that's able to be in this position. But, nah, this is, you know, divine. So I really don't get hype over stuff like that. I'll be hype when I get 100 million or a billion, something like that.
You clowns jiggy rapping, G like it, Biggie happen. This flash with pocket, get it cracking. I take action, no acting, I ain't playing with you. Real Wells gave me game, soap like kitty. K-Dot gave me respect, a homie like you crazy blessed. We finna blow like C4 with no bull in that text. Yes, Mike Jack wouldn't make it in this thriller. Watch up, watch everybody get familiar. One for the money, two for my bros, three for the city, now everybody know.
So one of the lines, Mike Jack wouldn't make it in this thriller. You were talking about Kansas City?
Indeed, yes.
What did you mean by that?
Also in a song I got called Quiet Place, just to tie this all together, I said, my little cousin talking about he killed for a thrill. His big brother 14, he tripping off a pill, and his big bro getting wet. Imagine how my auntie feel. You know.
And then you say, welcome to my quiet place.
Exactly. You know. So this is all the stuff that I see or have seen growing up here. You know, and I just paint the picture of it, you know, the way that I seen it. And that eventually shows, you know, you wouldn't make it here just as an average person. You got to be strong. You got to be tough.
So how did you come up with your name?
That's my real name. Yes, ma'am.
Is it really?
Yeah.
G-E-E.
Watts. Watts. Oh, named okay. after my daddy.
Oh, okay. Yeah. I thought it was a stage name.
Nah, no, ma'am. No faking to it.
So what part of Kansas City did you grow up in?
North side, northeast side on 4315 Jackson, 4311 Spruce, which is right down the street from there, 10th and Garfield, 10th and Olive, off of Hardesty and Independence Ave. Mm-hmm. We've lived in like 13, 14 different houses. Mm-hmm. So, you know, I've been everywhere scattered throughout, but mainly, you know, the north and the east part.
So what was growing up in Kansas City like for you? Real talk.
For me, you know, growing up as a kid, I had a lot of people that would use me because I had both of my parents in the house, and so I was privileged a little bit. I'd get, you know, I had a basketball goal outside our crib, and so people would come over and we'd play ball and stuff like that. But other than that, if they wouldn't try and hoop, they wouldn't try and rock with me. But that was because, you know, I was a bad little spoiled brat, you know what I'm saying, considering what I was growing up in. And then whenever I moved schools out of the inner city, I said in premature hate, actually, talk about when my mama told me to take a knife to school or whatever, and then I got kicked out of my elementary. I went to Fairview Alternative after that. And then being in there, my mom and daddy was like, man, this is just stifling you, because my work was like in a packet. We really didn't have like real work. We just had a packet, and you go through the packet, you good. So it's like, hell nah, excuse me. And I was like, nah, you know what I'm saying? You need to do some real work. And so my mama is actually from the Kansas side. Her whole family stay in Kansas. And I ended up going to school in Kansas. And being there, I got to see that side of life. And I got to realize I ain't ish. You know what I'm saying? My little gifts that my mom and daddy throw to me ain't nothing compared to, you know, how some other kids got it. And that humbled me fast, you know. And so then I started being able to have more friends and stuff like that. But growing up, I just had my cousins, you know what I'm saying? And I rock like that. Really couldn't trust too many.
Now, you lost a good friend at a young age. What impact did that have on you?
Not to speak negatively, but when that happens at such a young age, all it do is make you numb to it, at least for me, definitely. When I seen him laid in the middle of the street as a 9-year-old kid, me and him being like 14 at the time, you think that that's common and that's normal. So then whenever it do end up happening again, you know, it's like kind of second nature. In the past month, I've lost 3 cousins and a homeboy, you know, and so.
Gun violence?
Two was gun violence, one was a car crash, and the other was a suicide. So.
I'm so sorry.
Yeah.
So I know in your music, and we'll talk more about your music later, that you talk about the fact that Kansas City can be a rough place, though, to grow up.
Mm-hmm. It can, if you allow it to be, you allow it. You got a whole bunch of people that's trying to raise they self, and the game that they getting is through some fairy tale rap music or, you know, fictional movies or fake gangsters in TV. You know what I'm saying? And that ends up just bringing out the worst in everything and everybody, you know? Mm-hmm. So when you grow up amongst that and you have that as your blueprint, what you gonna get? You know what I'm saying? It's easy to be enticed if you don't surround yourself by the right folks. Of course, you know, all my homeboys were growing up in the same part of town that I grew up in. So not only are they from the same city, but for the most part, they're from the same spot. And watching them, because I'm the youngest one out of all my homies, watching all them strive for better. They got 9-to-5s, you know what I'm saying? Most of them don't smoke. A few of them do, but most of them don't. So it's easy for me to take the good out of each one of them and try to implement it in my life, thank God, because I got older homies who know game and they give me game, you know what I'm saying?
So at what point did you start getting interested in writing rhyme and rapping?
When I was like 2 years old, I actually used to go down. It's a park, it's still there, but it used to jump a little bit more back in the day. I would rap. My pops would pull out a little suitcase, and I'd stand on the suitcase, and I'd perform, and they'd give me, like, you know, $1 here, $2 there. But, you know, so it's been in me since a youngin'. But I started writing, I want to say, eighth grade, when I heard T.I.'s Urban Legend and Kanye Late Registration.
I have to tell you that when I listened to Trust Nobody, I felt really kind of sad because I started thinking about what kind of world would it be if you couldn't trust anybody.
Yeah, uh-huh. I don't trust these at all.
Trust, easy to lose, but it's hard to earn. I don't play around with these clowns, keep my stance firm. To all you lame, just rocking the same clothes, then post a cute pic on Twitter and thanking you that thing. No! To all the.
How have your experiences led you to that place?
Well, to this point, I feel like you can't trust nobody 100%, period. Maybe that's wrong. Maybe it's right. I feel like you should love all, trust few. You know what I'm saying? You should love most. You know what I'm saying? And trust none 100%.
So you want to do a little rhyme while you're in the studio?
Oh, yeah. I think I'll do that for you.
All right. Go on right ahead. What are we going to hear?
I just wrote this. So, and it's the one that I know by heart right now. Staring at these brick walls where I'm having a withdrawal. What direction I'm headed? I'm begging to take the chip off my shoulder. Can't hold them. Them grudges cause a quick fall. Get clipped if you cross the wrong bro. Pray Chris Paul will be the one. Froze cold when he squeezed a gun. Barrel on my liver. I quiver knowing this day will come. Native tongue of young killers trying to suffice it with drum drillers. Sherm stick motors fold none quicker. Killing they self. Dying of thirst. Needing some help. Talent on shelf. Belief nowhere to be felt. See, prideful's what I'm not. Pride won't find the belt. Aiming to get the title before my rival come and melt. The skin I'm in with Mac 10 tears. Crying out for help. Pellets penetrating my peers. 2K12. Goddamn. One hell of a year. 13 started off worse. I knew my blessing was near. Fear. Can't have none. Strengthen your spleen. At 9, I saw a big homie fall at 14. His body lay lifeless. His blood covered his jeans. Tim's on his feet. Bumblebee tape marking the scene. Still to this very day, I hear his mama scream. Growing up this way, imagine the drama it brings. Trying past that, trying to resonate while I earn every opportunity before I burn. A lot of rappers talk that talk, so I smooth watch, giving game out like 50 Iveens inside the dock. Again, talk that talk, Huey on Boondock. Ill Will got it right. I'm Huey on that rooftop. Yes, ma'am.
All right. All right. Yeah, I like that flow.
Thank you. And you didn't even hear the beat. Imagine when you hear the beat with it. Ooh.
It's going to be nasty.
Oh, you know it. You know it.
So what's next for G-Watts?
I'm coming out with a video to Nasty. Yes, she dancing. come out with a video to Nasty. And also just try to push this mixtape as much as possible because I feel like the music, like I said, resonate. It's a decent body of work. And so therefore, I want it to be heard on a level it deserves to be heard at, not just a local level and a few folks outside of this scene hearing it. I want everybody to be able to hear it as much as possible, you know. So once that's done, then we'll start talking about new music. But until then, we're just going to push this.
G, thank you for joining us in the KCUR studios.
Thank you for having me.
This story first aired back in May. G-Watts performs next on August 31st. He's opening for Chief Keef at the Uptown Theater.
If you can't listen to all of Casey Currents today, catch what you missed online in our audio archives. And we've got a podcast. Find us on iTunes.
After the break, the latest in our Creative Couples series. This is Casey Currents.
This is Casey Currents. I'm Alex Smith.
And I'm Susan Wilson.
It seems like there's a greeting card for everything these days.
Everyone's nervous going back to school.
General Crafts to Enterprise. Spock here. Happy holidays.
We're friends.
Yeah.
This Valentine's Day, play it safe.
with the Hallmark mix.
Hallmark has a selection of cards for people who just lost their job.
Yes, there are even cards for losing your job. But what about a card for being in hospice or at the end stages of life? That's the idea of a high-profile patient advocate who's turned her attention to Kansas City because of Hallmark, of course. But as KCOR's Alana Gordon reported back in March, such a concept is not so easy to materialize.
Regina Holiday is a patient activist in Washington, D.C. She mostly focuses on access to health data, and her work has caught the attention of national leaders like the health IT coordinator for the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services. But Holiday wasn't always involved in D.C. She has fond memories of living in Kansas about 15 years ago.
I once ran the Jayhawk bookstore in Lawrence, Kansas.
Whoa.
Yeah.
Her husband, Fred, was earning a Ph.D. in film studies at KU.
His dissertation was on Buffy the Vampire Slayer.
He then taught film at American University in Washington. But in 2009, he fell ill quickly. When he was hospitalized, they learned he was at the end stages of kidney cancer.
And so we had this roller coaster of care for 2 months, and then it led to hospice.
Holiday says it was such a hard time, and not just because her husband was dying, but because of how isolated they felt, even from those who cared about them.
We noticed people stopped calling. There wasn't as much communication. It seemed like people didn't know what to say. And you'd occasionally get like a thinking of you or a blank card, or sadly, we even got a couple sympathies. And that was the final month of his life.
Holiday's husband died that spring. But over time, she realized their experience underscored a much larger problem in society.
People don't talk about death very much. People don't want to say the word, the big D word, or talk about that what's going to happen next. And because of that, we actually often leave our dying friends and family alone. And a lot of people wait till it's far too late to have a call or a card or a visit.
That was really troubling to her. It still is. Holiday then thought about her Jayhawk bookstore days and one of the items that took up a big portion of the store.
There was a whole bunch of cards. We had a huge footprint of cards.
She got to thinking, what if there were another section next to the birthday and graduation cards?
They also have headers that said hospice. I think that starts the conversation. And I thought it could be incredibly powerful.
So she turned to an obvious source.
Hey, what a card can say for you.
And petitioned the largest greeting card company in the U.S., headquartered here in Kansas City.
I'm going to keep this forever.
Hear what a Hallmark card can do.
I think at any given time, we probably have 20,000 different cards out there.
Linda Odell is a spokesperson for Hallmark.
There are lots of cards that are about offering care and concern and hoping for a good day and praying for you.
Odell says about 15 years ago, Hallmark came out with a line of cards for difficult situations. There have been several variations since then. Odell's familiar with Regina Holiday's recent efforts, and the company has issued a response. On the one hand, it made them realize how hard it was to find their cards that might be appropriate for hospice situations. In fact, if you typed in end of life into Hallmark's online search engine, cards from the Tree of Life line would come up.
So, cards that were appropriate for bat mitzvah.
Whoops.
We fixed those things.
But Odell says creating an overt hospice card line is more complicated. Odell admires Holiday's efforts and recognizes that each person's experience is different. But here's the thing. Hallmark has already thought about hospice cards.
Hallmark exists to help people make positive emotional connections with one another. As such, we obviously are always paying attention to what's going on in society and what people are saying to each other. But we are a reflection of that conversation. We're not pushing the conversation forward.
Odell says they're always listening, but they're listening to a lot of people.
This is a very sensitive topic, and we have to be equally alert to those who would feel like it was really inappropriate to have cards that overtly speak to hospice and end of life.
Have you heard that perspective as well?
Absolutely.
I think they were a little afraid of it from a business perspective, and I get that.
Myra Christopher is founding director of the Center for Practical Bioethics in Kansas City. She's deeply involved in national policy discussions around end-of-life care. And back in the 90s, Christopher met with members of Hallmark's creative team to discuss the very same thing that Holiday is now pushing for, designing end-of-life and hospice-themed cards.
Well, it was really fascinating. I mean, these are really smart people. And the team we met with mostly were really young people. And, you know, we sat around a big conference table and we just brainstormed. And
Christopher doesn't recall specifics of what happened next, except the concept just wasn't in line with Hallmark's plans at that point. To be clear, Christopher loves Hallmark and their cards. Her center has led trainings for Hallmark employees, and the company has donated to the center. Christopher's familiar with Holiday, too. She wasn't aware of her greeting card efforts until we spoke, but totally understands where Holiday's coming from.
There is a real, really urgent need for honest, candid discussion at every level in our society about these issues. I just had a conversation this week with a friend, a quite elderly friend, where I said to her, I hope that your death is not prolonged and that your passing is peaceful. And she said, I wish people would say that to me instead of saying, oh, we hope you get better.
So I asked Christopher what she and other researchers have found are ways to help with this, especially on a personal level. I also asked Regina Holiday what she thinks, what kinds of messages she would want to see in cards. And the answers I got from both of them, even though the conversations were different, had a lot of similarities.
One of the hardest things is the wish that you could take this. That you could take this from them. So, a card that will address that.
I want you to know how much I have loved and valued.
Come right out and say it.
What you've meant to me in my life, and that I'm going to miss you.
I'll miss you.
And that I'm grateful for you.
Those kind of statements.
We need to remember that this is such a precious time in someone's life, and there can be great joy, great meaning, great creativity.
You know, the kind of things that you want to hear, that open up the bridges, that open up the conversation that's just missing right now.
Holiday says funny approach could be powerful too, if that person has a sense of humor. Christopher admits that in all her years doing this work, reaching out to someone can still be hard, even if there is a card. She says in the end, it's not about what's written or what's said, but about being there. Even a note that really doesn't say anything at all, she says, except thinking of you, with your name on it, would be a blessing and a gift. Reporting for Casey Currents, I'm Alana Gordon.
This month on Casey Currents, we've been talking to some of Kansas City's most creative couples. It's a series inspired by the work of iconic Mexican artists Frida Kahlo and Diego Rivera on display at the Nelson Atkins Museum of Art. Kahlo and Rivera have a famously tempestuous relationship, which sometimes inspired their art. This week's couple met while studying at the Central Conservatory of Music in Beijing, China. Chen Yi and Zhou Long were among the first students to be allowed to study Western classical music after the Cultural Revolution. For more than a decade, Chen and Zhou have lived in Kansas City, teaching composition at the UMKC Conservatory of Music and Dance. Despite similar backgrounds and influences, their individual voices keep their work distinct. KCUR's Julie Denishay has the story.
So my name is Chen Yi. I'm married to Zhou Long, and Zhou Long is my husband. We both are music composers. We both are professors at UMKC Conservatory, and then we both came from China. Both are very much devoted to the combination of East and West. Still, I could tell the difference from our characteristics. For example, the color. And his music is more delicate. I would say that kind of instrumentation in different groupings that would form different colors that you may tell right away that, oh, that is not Chan Yi. And for me, I have a kind of a big stroke, this kind of a passion and more dramatic shape, or this type also you may tell that is me. So you can still tell different from each of us.
I'm Zhou Long, a composer, and I'm married to Chen Yi. Originally, I came from Beijing. I was born in Beijing. Well, I think the artists who live together, you know, some, especially in the same profession, and I'm a very quiet person, but we both have a very strong personality. So we give harsh comments.
We are 60 this year. We got married when we were 30. And so this year, in July, it was absolutely 30 years. I think we have a lot of common language every day talking. When we finish our own work, we always get common from each other. And sometimes we fight.
You know, sometimes if you compose your own work, even this arrow, you can't see it. Because you look at it every day, you don't see it, it's too familiar. So I think the other criticism is very helpful. And for us, you know, the first audience, and we gave a very direct comment and criticism, and that really helped. And sometimes hurt the mood. But as an artist, you know, that's the job, you have to do it.
We train our students. You got to study hard to earn your experience little bit by little bit. You cannot jump from here to there. It is a kind of a collection you have to gain patiently.
See photos of Chen Yi and Zhou Long at their home and find more stories of Kansas City's creative couples on our website, kcur.org. We really appreciate you tuning in to KC Currents. This show will be archived along with all of our past shows on the KC Currents page at kcur.org.
You can also hear individual stories there or sign up for our podcast or find us on iTunes. Contact us at kcurrents@kcur.org or on Twitter at kcurrents.
KC Currents is produced by Sylvia Maria Gross. Alex Smith is our associate producer and our intern is Monica Sandretsky. Our theme music is by Approach, and as always, I'm Susan Wilson.
And I'm Alex Smith.